again. In about 10 to 15 minutes time, go to our website, wbai.org. Right there on the home page, you'll get some directions on how to listen to this program. Again, Democracy Now! Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. without commercial interruption, thanks to listeners just like you. We've been broadcasting in the center of the FM dial here in New York City since 1960. Thanks to you, listeners just like you, all around this tri-state area and beyond, who have supported WBAI. We have folks standing by ready to take your calls right now by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You can also send a check or money order to the station. And the address is Pacifica-WBAI 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. It's 9 o'clock here in New York City, and coming up next, produced by Bonnie Faulkner, is Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
The question that I'm trying to lay out right now is the larger issue of the metaverse, in that blockchain is foundational to tracking assets from the material world into the digital world. Before advancing forward, what are the consequences? Because once we go far enough, I think it's going to be very hard to back out. And that has profound implications for babies and children and the unborn and all of the other beings that we share the world with if we decide to live in the metaverse. And the blockchain is the system that is required to make the metaverse happen.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Allison McDowell. Today's show, Blockchain Keys Unlock a Murky Metaverse. What you don't know about digital twins could hurt you. Allison McDowell is a pioneering independent researcher. Her journey into activism began as the parent of a public school student. In 2013, Boston Consulting Group closed 23 schools in Philadelphia. This led her to begin examining money, power, and influence in her city. Her work interrogates the global finance and technology interests that, under the rising biosecurity state, are advancing a transhumanist program that would virtualize humans as digital commodities to be fed into futures markets to profit hedge funds. What started out as one mom's attempt to rein in standardized testing and educational surveillance evolved into an international effort to catalyze a global peace movement against digital identity and the World Economic Forum's planned Internet of Bodies. Allison McDowell, welcome back.
Thank you, Bonnie. I'm glad to be chatting again.
It's great to have the chance to try and catch up with your work, or as much as is possible in 1 hour. I'd like to begin with a deep dive into blockchain, what it is, how it's constructed, and what it is being used for, and what it will be used for in the future. Most of us at this point are at least aware of cryptocurrency, be it Bitcoin or Ethereum or whatever. We may not understand it, but we know that it is used as an investment or a payment system. But blockchain itself, at a much more fundamental level, is, as you pointed out, the building block of the virtual metaverse. What is blockchain? How is it constructed, and where did it come from?
That's the question, right? I guess depending on where you think it comes from, depends on if it's liberation or incarceration. So essentially, my introduction to blockchain was different from most people. Most people get introduced to blockchain because they're involved in some sort of cryptocurrency investments or speculation or payment systems. My introduction to blockchain was about 3 years ago. In 2017, I believe it was, I was watching 4 hours of New America Think Tank and the World Bank on blockchain. And like sandwiched in the middle of the 4 hours, there was this guy, Sean Conway, who was at the time was something called Trust Lab. And it was all about humanitarian aid and how they were going to put all of the aid onto blockchain to track it, to make sure that nobody, you know, misused the resources such as they were. But when I got to digging in a little bit more into blockchain, it was very much about linking resources to individual digital identities. And I found out more about the World Wide Web Consortium's self-sovereign digital identity program, and that many of these programs that essentially assign a unique identifier initially for people, but ultimately the goal is like everything on the planet becomes tracked in this digital wireframe that's projected into a simulation. But it took me a while to get to that point. So Sean Conway was involved with something called also IXO Foundation and Innovation Edge in Cape Town, South Africa. And so what they were doing was offering reimbursement for early childhood pre-K providers on the condition that the children all be put on blockchain. And they framed it in this very benevolent and paternalistic terms that, you know, then they could earn social capital by going to preschool. But ultimately, it was all about sort of oversight and compliance purposes. And eventually, all of the metadata attached to that would be part of someone's digital footprint, their digital twin that they keep talking about. So my exposure to that, like, I mean, I found that really problematic to imagine that children then become these investment commodities and are tracked before they even have any idea what's going on in the world, that they're already starting to have their future, their past is already informing what their future course is going to take based on their data that is stored in their permanent ledger. This is very different from individuals who come into from maybe the crypto space who imagine it as like, oh, this is going to be wonderful because you'll be in control of your data. Not thinking that what it means is actually you will become a commodity. You will be a commodity who's maybe ostensibly a little bit more in charge of managing how you're a commodity. But at the foundational level, once you are tagged in the system, you have become a global commodity, whether you like it or not. So that's my sense of the blockchain is less about the money and more about identity management, which we can see. And, you know, I saw this coming the month after the pandemic was announced. You know, I was already writing things saying, OK, I think this is how this digital identity is going to come online now. You know, they're going to use national security interests and public health to sort of enforce a blockchain identity. And that is what is ultimately happening with these various medical passports that are, you know, at this point, somewhat optional in certain cases, but the goal is to make them more universal. So the blockchain itself essentially is a ledger system. Now that the people who advance blockchain as a good thing say, well, it's decentralized and it's very secure. And it's a way of keeping track of all of these bits of information. But ultimately, this ledger system was put in place to allow continued global economic growth in a way that would not be possible if we were to confine ourselves to the material physical limits of the natural world. Like eventually we were going to start to run out of resources. I mean, not everyday people necessarily, but those who are these giant asset holders and the war machine and other things are like consuming vast amounts of resources. And eventually they're going to sort of bump up against the material limits of the physical world. Once you build the metaverse, it's a digital world. And so while there are still, you know, energy requirements to run the servers and to manage the, you know, devices and the technology, it is a smaller amount than what the material world manifests. And especially once, you know, with Moore's Law, once they get it at quantum and nano, it will be even less consumption of energy to build a virtual world. And in the virtual world, I think they imagine that they can have this unlimited growth. That is the demand of sort of the framework of capitalism, as that is unending growth. And then therefore, essentially, we are turning our world into a synthetic world in order to maintain the growth that is expected.
And why is blockchain so hard to understand? What is it? I mean, it's a ledger system, but is it a series of letters or numbers? What is it?
Well, if you imagine, so it's tied in with the political economy, how it is structured. And if you understand it as an accounting system, not just a money system, but a transaction system, that transaction can include money, but it can also include a social transaction, a transaction with the built environment. Anything that can be made into a transaction can be logged on the ledger. The last time we had a really huge change in how the global economy worked was, you know, in the age of discovery and maritime trade, and that sort of age that also much of that trade was in enslaved people, right? And instead of just going to a marketplace and a buyer and seller exchange items and currency in the moment and then it was settled, the global trade with the sailing ships had to be done across time and space, right? They had to have a way of keeping track of accounts. And so the double entry bookkeeping that originated in Africa and then was widely adopted through the Catholic Church in Europe at that time became what was needed to allow that economic system to expand, you know, to its logical conclusion. So now the next series is to allow the digital world to transact. Blockchain is about tracking digital assets. And so that is inherently what it is. Instead of double entry like an accounting book, it's a series of blocks, you know, what they conceive of as blocks. And often you'll see in terms of design ways, if you pivot a 3D wireframe of a cube, it's also a hexagon. So you'll see hexagons used very widely in a lot of design motifs and these cubes. So it's the idea that you create lines of cubes that are sandwiched into place with cryptography, with these challenging electronic puzzles that when computing systems successfully process the puzzles, they can get rewarded in Bitcoin or the token payments for the work, quote unquote, proof of work of putting that together. Now, that's quite challenging to bring to scale. And so what we're seeing now, it's energy intensive and it's time intensive. And we're used to things happening immediately, right? Like if you want to send a payment to someone in India, like you're not going to wait for your digital transaction to take a couple hours to clear. Like you want it pretty much instantaneous. And that is very challenging to do within the existing blockchain system at scale, right? If everybody started to do that, the whole system, there would be too much cryptography to happen. And so what they've done is they've created side chains and other layers, like Bitcoin, it's the Blockstream has a Lightning Network protocol. And a lot of the blockchain platforms have additional layers that sort of do the work over to the side and then like loop it back in. But in doing that is actually less secure. So it's sort of a workaround. You've got the main blockchain and then you have these side chains. And then ultimately the next layers that are coming in are these smart contracts, which are essentially what they sound like. They're contracts, but they're written into computer code. And when the conditions of contracts are verified with data, then they automatically process. So these are other layers that are coming in. You know, Cardano is one of the largest blockchain identity case uses coming online now in Ethiopia. And my understanding is they just had a big conference a couple weeks ago where they announced their smart contract layer, which is called Hydra. That's quite interesting to watch and see how they've branded Hydra because it's essentially this purple dragon with multiple heads flying around and implying like these side chains and these, you know, connections with their smart contracts are like Hydras, which are a bit intimidating actually. If you look at how they branded it, those Hydras have pretty sharp teeth. So it's an interesting choice of representation of the scheme.
You mentioned the hexagons, and we touched on that in our first show, these hexagonal tiles. Now, if you wanted to look at a blockchain, could you see one? And if you could, what would it look like?
I mean, I don't think that you're actually, I mean, see
I'm those. Sorry. See I'm those. Sorry to be so literal, but I'm kind of dumb on this.
Well, I mean, if you imagine like data stored in server farms, it's like there are many electronical systems in the world that are sort of beyond our ability to perceive of them with our current senses, if that makes sense. Like, I mean, what they are doing is if regular people had to navigate all the cryptography and the public keys and the private keys and all of this stuff, like in a very literal computational framework, it would be over the heads of most people. And so what they do is they come up with stuff called like decentralized apps and wallets that make the interface simpler and make it look just like sort of an online payment system as opposed to something that is much more complex with the cryptography. But yeah, I mean, it's data that lives in a server farm. So what does that look like, right? The idea is that the data is stored over many, many different computing systems, server systems, so that it cannot be hacked. And so that is the framework for it not being it being secure. Now, the challenge with the security on that is when you start having wallets and apps and sidechains and things, and then you introduce vulnerabilities into the system, both human error and other, you know, intentional and accidental.
Right, because you have pointed out that blockchain is hackable, but you also feel that blockchain is dangerous. Is that correct? And if so, why?
Well, I mean, the blockchain people will say it's not hackable. I will say there are vulnerabilities in the larger structural systems, okay? So just to clarify that. What I'm trying to say is that while the vast majority of people who talk about blockchain are talking about it mostly as a financial transaction, increasingly people are understanding it as an identity system because of what's been unfolding around the health passport systems, the medical passporting. People are starting to understand about having a digital identifier that's linked to how you are able to move in the world. So that's, you know, that's another piece. The question that I'm trying to lay out right now is the larger issue of the metaverse, in that blockchain is foundational to tracking assets from the material world into the digital world. And things that are just fully digital assets that never come out of the digital world, other than maybe you see them, that you have them on a device, right? These NFTs and that sort of thing. And then my larger question is, are we going to agree as a society that avatar life, living as an avatar, where a significant amount of our lived experience is in digital space, is what we want? And then knowing that many of these technologies, the creation of online digital spaces are tied into military research and development and simulation, many of like the video game worlds and the simulation worlds, so that we may inhabit digital spaces and feel like they are liberating. But ultimately, it's kind of like what I talk about Google. Google has like all sorts of amazing things, but you agree to live in Google's box, and if Google doesn't do it, then you're not having that, right? So if we agree to live in the metaverse, all of the amazing things of being a real person, both beautiful and terrifying, of being a living being in a natural world, will start to crumble away, I think. And Werner Vinge, who is a math computer science emeritus professor at UC San Diego, he was the one who first postulated the singularity. And he has a really interesting book called Rainbow's End. And in this book, it was sort of positing a near future dystopia where the real world falls apart as everyone starts to wear wearable technology and live in an augmented world, so that everybody just chooses their own on-demand version of the world. And I don't think that we are fully prepared morally to advance into these spaces before having bigger conversations. And I think we have to, as a society, both in the United States and abroad, understand that this is the next phase of manifest destiny, is the metaverse. And how did that work out the last time for the original people? Not so great. And before advancing forward, what are the consequences? Because once we go far enough, I think it's going to be very hard to back out. And that has profound implications for babies and children and the unborn and all of the other beings that we share the world with. if we decide to live in the metaverse. And the blockchain is the system that is required to make the metaverse happen.
I'm speaking with pioneering independent researcher Alison McDowell. Today's show, Blockchain Keys Unlock a Murky Metaverse. What you don't know about digital twins could hurt you. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
I wanted to ask you, what does it mean to blockchain someone? Is this something that can be done to a person? For instance, I saw you post on Twitter about humanitarian donations being given to impoverished people in blockchain in other countries to buy food. What does this entail, and is it pernicious?
Well, so part of the element of the blockchain, the finance piece, is that the value in those tokens, the money such as it is, can be programmed, right? Much of the work that I have done, you know, pre-pandemic was around what I see as a predatory aspect of using social problems and trauma and vulnerable populations to create new ways of generating value for the most elite wealthy people of the world, essentially managed poverty. And not that poverty hasn't always been managed in a certain way, but when combined with the capture of biometric data and smart city sensor networks and, you know, satellite surveillance systems, becomes really, really repressive. But it's all framed in ways that are supposed to sound laudable and you know, like these folks are benefactors. So a lot of, as I had mentioned earlier, these programs were piloted through global aid systems. Now they're coming back to the United States. I'm going to be going down to Austin this week, and Austin has its own blockchain identity program to track unhoused people and their medical records. So it's not exclusively in war-torn or, you know, global South countries. But these big pots of money, and who would stand up for those communities, right? There's not a lot of people who would intervene if they saw something go amiss, especially if it was being framed as a good thing. So the Syrian refugees in particular were a pilot, and they would gather people's retinal scans and attach their food assistance to it. So when they go to the grocery store, they would pay with a retinal scan. And some of these payment systems were in Scandinavia, right? So you think of, these are countries with a lovely social safety net and they're so nice, but really they're not above putting dispossessed people and gathering their biometric information and demanding that as a condition. So to me, once you have someone's biometrics in these systems, and once you start to connect it into state surveillance, machine learning for artificial intelligence, you know, that's the thing about blockchain, is it's supposed to be permanent, right? Your permanent record. And people end up sort of being pushed into a corner often to end up in these systems of blockchain, not realizing the larger consequences. Now, the question is, will these blockchain identities ultimately coalesce? Like, would you have multiple blockchain identities that are attached to multiple systems? I think in this transition point, yes. But ultimately, the value of data both to machine learning systems and to social impact investing systems is that it's all interoperable, that they essentially begin to track all of your data, all of your purchase patterns. They're going to be working on getting physiological data from you, both from implantable and wearable technologies, your education data, the media you consume, all of that, and being poured into a digital twin, not only of individuals, but of used to model whole societies and eventually like a planetary computer. You know, imagine, I think in some ways, some of these folks might picture that they're going to, I don't know, bring heaven on earth when they have, you know, God replaced by artificial intelligence as a decentralized autonomous organization, right? Like the ultimate corporate personhood, right? The corporate artificial deification of natural life, which I find incredibly just a manifestation of the level of domination of sort of Western scientism, like quote unquote enlightened scientism upon the world. So I find that incredibly dangerous. I'm sure there are many people out there who would say, well, you know, how else are we going to take care of the poor? How else are we going to track people if they leave their house without their identity papers? How else are we going to do these things? But I think the world as it exists currently, with power concentrated in the hands of essentially a global finance defense sector that has very sophisticated levels of coercion, both psychological, behavioral, physical, through the technologies, that we should not be rushing into this. And so some of it comes with food assistance. As I said, in Austin, this MyPass project that was funded by Bloomberg Philanthropies and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation was a health record, so electronic health records, that could be one. Electronic transcripts for college, that's going to be one that's rolling out. That's a big part of what's going on in Texas with Greenlight Credentials and Highland, which is came out of Learning Machine. The goal is electronic government on blockchain. The state of Illinois piloted a birth certificate program. Can babies consent to being on blockchain? You know, clearly they cannot. The first blockchain babies were born in Tanzania in 2018. That baby was tracked. Their mother's compliance to the medical protocol was tracked on blockchain before that child was born, and that went into their record. So for me, these are all incredibly troubling, because I don't think that we can trust the systems to have the interests of vulnerable communities at heart, especially once we start to look at what's happening with ESG, environmental, social governance investing, social impact investing, how all of this is being tied to the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals for education and poverty and hunger and healthcare, into a planetary computing system. I have a lot of questions. And so if we as a society had a very robust conversation about it that really looked at the long range history and the history of social policy as having sort of a military imperial underpinning, and I was outnumbered, well, then I would feel like God put me here and I did my best, you know, to have the conversation. But right now, I'm really just asking people to have the bigger conversation, because it's far more complex than that we need some sort of an alternative digital payment system, or that it's limited to a vaccine passport, because it's much, much bigger than that.
You have pointed out, and I would heartily agree, that there is no way that we as adults are going to be retrofitted into this brave new augmented reality. Could you explain why we, as adults, will never be suited for this, and that it's the yet-to-be-born and the very young who are going to be groomed to live in the metaverse?
Sure. Well, this is a concept I'm still sort of working out. So I'd be glad to be wrong. And when I say that we're not going to be retrofit, it's not that I think that they're going to come and, like, you know, wipe us all off the face of the planet in the next couple of years. I think there's still value in elder people for feeding data into this machine, right? We would have a unique data set that the AI would be interested in. I sort of imagine this as this sort of larger predator energy system that really, really wants to be human, but is very abusive to the teachers of us being teachers of it, trying to teach it how to be human, that it won't ever get there, get the soul, but really wants it really hard. So essentially, when I was working in the education space, I was bumping up against quite a bit of money pouring into something called executive function research in young children. And I didn't quite understand it, because why would you need that for kids? I mean, you might need it as an impact investing scheme or data metrics, but it didn't make much sense to me in terms of the imperative of managing executive function, managing it interfaces with resilience, mindfulness, grit, until I started better understanding mixed reality. And that the metaverse, you know, it has various elements. Some of it lives exclusively digitally, but then the plan is to remake the physical world with additional layers of information. So if you imagine the material environment outside your house, or even inside your house, being layered like a computer aided design map, or, you know, a GIS map that you could add or subtract layers of information. And I think that amount of information is too much for the human mind at present to process all at once, to be forced into a moment that instead of having a natural synthesis of the information that you see in the world around you that helps inform in your view of the world and helps you make decisions about how you navigate the world from your own internal compass, that all of it is sort of brought up at once and thrown at your face. And then that would make you just want to bury your face in your hands, right? It would be too much. I sort of say, you know, you don't even imagine how many things you don't notice, right? Sometimes you're driving and then you think, oh, you're on a road that you know all the time, right? And you just realize like you hadn't really noticed the last few minutes, right? Because you're in that zone of knowing it. Or, you know, I had a vase of wilted flowers on my kitchen table from the farmer's market. And over the course of the day, I probably walked by that vase of wilted flowers three or four times before it registered to me that, oh, I should probably put those in the compost, right? So some part of my consciousness was seeing it, my eyes were seeing it, but it didn't register as actionable information till at some point, but that came internal for me. And so if you imagine like our consciousness being bombarded with so much information of the metaverse and navigating it, I sort of imagine it like, you know, when people talk about what it's like to be on the spectrum and being overwhelmed by social cues or noise or sensory information, that level of discomfort is something that with the metaverse, most everyone is going to be pushed into. And those of us who have a way of navigating the world, our brain has its own physiology, its own sort of schema shortcuts that help us make decisions more quickly. And it's still plastic to a certain extent, but we have ways that we think about these things. We have worldviews. We have, you know, unless we have something big to change how we see the world, we mostly just sort of tweak around the edges by the time you're, you know, in your 40s or 50s. It's going to be harder for us to navigate the metaverse in this augmented cognition, because this goes into wearable technology that the military has been working on for quite some time, is that you would actually have like a headpiece that would amplify or suppress information depending on a situation, right? They frame it as being in a situation room, and that you would have windows that would open and close and get bigger and smaller depending on how you should process the information, all the information coming at you. But I think the idea is ultimately that there would be some augmented wearable that would be doing that modulation for you in the metaverse. That would be really uncomfortable for most older people. But I think for the children, they're the ones in the 2030, 2050 time horizon that will be the young adults of what they imagine the age of the metaverse unfolding to be. And so the executive function research, I think, and the focus on cognitive neuroscience in very young children, and while it is woven into impact investing, I think it is about trying to figure out how to begin to shape their minds to fit into a world, into the world that is being made, this world of data, this world of data analytics, of wireframes, of smart contracts. So that's sort of where I'm at this point. I'm not saying that we're going to be, you know, eliminated, but I think that there are actual implications for how our neurological function of these young children will need to be to not have their minds fall apart in the world as it's coming. So, you know, these are all things I think we should be talking about.
I'm speaking with pioneering independent researcher Alison McDowell. Today's show, Blockchain Keys Unlock a Murky Metaverse. What you don't know about digital twins could hurt you. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Well, yes. For instance, why is it that the new generation, which is being trained to be part of this digital metaverse, have to be able to process information differently than we as adults do? How are the very young being changed to navigate within what you describe as an augmented cognition framework, a template of human plus, you've said?
You know, again, and I will just reiterate, this is sort of my conjecturing, my thinking out loud based on things that I'm reading, right? And so mostly a lot of these technologies are dual use, and they frame them as one way, and then that there's other things going on. So my sense is that the navigating the information is really crucial. And so a big part of what is coming online with blockchain in this fourth industrial revolution is the idea that you will have a digital twin. And this is something that is spoken about in quite a bit of detail by Nippon Telephone and Telegraph. They have a report from early this spring that talks about their plans to essentially digitally mirror individuals and societies and material environments, and then to optimize them. Now, digital twins have been around for a long time, but they're mostly mechanical. And so you might have a twin of an engine, say, and that twin of an engine lives in a digital space, and you can use, you know, AI systems to figure out an optimal functioning calibration for the engine. And then you can capture that, and then you can apply that those findings, and you can run them much faster than you could on the actual engine without breaking it, the way if you had to do it on real engine. And then you get the best, the optimization you want, and then you apply that to the real engine. When I look and see how they're talking about digital twinning, which the open door to this is electronic health records and precision medicine and personalized medicine and things that are linked to like innovative high-tech medicine that will very likely include, the way they talk about it, nanoelectronics and these various, you know, nanobots in your bloodstream and all sorts of life extension programs. It's hard to imagine. I mean, haven't even figured out a lot of terrible, you know, age-related illnesses yet. But they, you know, this is how they talk about it, that they will create digital twins of people. And then the optimization that would happen between the digital engine and the regular engine, there's someone at the control system saying what the optimization intent is. How did you want that engine to function? My larger question is, and for these children, is if you start to build a digital twin, you build a digital twin when, you know, a pregnant woman who's on Medicaid starts to get prenatal care on electronic health record, and then you track that child where they go to preschool, and then you track all of their school scores, and then you track all of their medical care, and you track their zip code and their housing vouchers and their SNAP benefits and what they eat and all of these things. If there's an optimization happening through the twin, which is how Nippon Telegraph and Telephone speaks about it, they say the real person will affect the twin, but our goal is to have the twin affect the material person. Who gets to decide how a child is optimized, right? I mean, we have in literature the idea of these caste systems, you know, people who are engineered to fulfill certain parts of society, right? I mean, that literally that we joke about, well, just being a cogs in the machine, but literally, and not just people, because this will be the same for plants and animals and microbes and all of these things, that those who are viewing the world as a planetary computer are going to say, well, where does this thing, we need some more of this part, or this part is about to wear out. We need some lead time on the supply chain. And the blockchain is about tracking the supply chain systems. So, I don't know if that helps explain it, but I mean, I think it's the optimization and who decides. And I know that the world isn't fair. It's already not fair. But I think it will get more oppressive. And I think the sophistication of the steering systems, these digital nudges tied in with behavioral economics and labor force development and planned economies, will get to a point. I mean, for me, it's hard to imagine if it will get so extreme that people won't even notice anymore. And that's hard for me to imagine, but that's sort of where will they get sophisticated enough that people won't realize what's happening to them? And then some days when I'm really like out there, I think, well, maybe it's already happened and we're already living in that world and somebody's engineering my digital twin from some remote place. But I don't know. I guess we just have to do our best and have faith in like a higher power that it will work out.
Now, from what you were saying, it sounded like the direction that they're headed in is to have your virtual twin actually control you rather than vice versa. Did you mean to imply that this may be where they're headed?
I think that is, yes. I mean, Nippon Telegraph and Telephone in their paper has said that that is what they would like to see happen. I mean, it says at this point, it doesn't say that they've done it. So that's good. But then I think with knowing that and having that in mind, we really need to think very carefully about going down this road of even having digital twins. you know?
Right.
And I will say, like, I'm going to be going to Austin, and, you know, I was looking at, there was a federal release, a committee report about sort of the ethics of AI and implications, and the gentleman who is chairing that committee, his name is Peter Stone, and he's a computer professor at Austin, and he's the new head of Sony AI in North America. But I think in some respects we imagine, like, oh, well, that's just the, you know, Japan Science and Technology Agency, their cyborg avatar capitalism project, and Nippon Telegraph and Telephone or SoftBank. It's not here. But we're in the midst of these global systems, and the technology systems are very much global. And, you know, a lot of the technological systems coming out of Japan have very checkered past regarding the aftermath of World War II and some really terrible experimentation that took place that essentially was never prosecuted or surfaced. The Unit 731 and the U.S. government, for security purposes, just sort of wiped it under the rug and took the findings and kept them and moved on around bioweapons and some mass atrocities around that. So we have to understand that these large multinational technology companies, if you go back, if you walk back in history, I think people have a right to sort of question the overall ethics as part of this larger conversation. Like, who would we trust with our digital twin? I mean, to me, there are quite a number of people who are very interested in this idea of the straw man and trading on people's straw man. But I think in some ways, the digital twin is this idea of the central banking straw man coming out into the open, right? And being legitimized and then being part of these human capital bond markets.
Right. And as you pointed out, that if their aim is to get your digital twin to control you, then of course the logical next question is, who's controlling the digital twin?
Right. I know. That is the bigger question. And that is, I think, one of my big concerns around artificial intelligence right now is that I've been digging into, you know, my frame is a lot about history because I live in Philadelphia, and there's the history that is commonly understood history, and then there are these sort of secret subplots of history that you don't find out about till later. And so recently I've been looking into Thomas Scott, who was the chair of the Pennsylvania Railroad, which at the time was the largest global corporation, and the push to have a corporate citizenship, corporations recognized by the courts as citizens as back as early as the 1880s. And they sort of scammed their way through it. But this idea of what is the role of the corporation in society, and this was, Scott went through, there was like the railroad strike of 1877 and this general strike of the railroads, and there was great harm and many people killed and because of these robber barons, right? And so that infrastructure is still in place. I mean, sometimes it hides behind, you know, innovation and progress, but it's all still very much there. And so I keep thinking, well, the next phase of this is, you know, we have concentrated wealth in the hands of these small holding companies. But then eventually, what if it gets consolidated down to like one unit, right? Like the artificial intelligence, decentralized autonomous organization. And the other piece about blockchain that I forgot to mention is they're also conjecturing about putting your mind on blockchain. There's a woman, her name is Melanie Swan, and she's done a lot of research and conjecturing about that we would put our minds and our thought processes and our memories into blockchain. So, you know, again, dual use. If you have a stroke, they can just re-upload you, right? But imagine like having blockchains of brains and this force, you know, of trying to be human force, like trying to get in the back door to learn what the essence is of being human, what the essence is of natural life, not just humans, but, you know, other beings here, of trying to get in. But also, I think in some respects, it feels like having a certain level of disgust with natural beings, too. So it's this yin yang side of things. But yeah, that would be the ultimate corporation, is if you have like all of our brains on blockchain, run by a global planetary computer. You know, I guess that's HAL or whatever.
It's interesting that you mentioned the railroad, because I just saw a picture of the railroad being put through in the, you know, in the old days in the United States, and it was a picture of this iron horse, this railroad coming through, and guys with rifles on both sides shooting all the buffalo so that they could bring the train through. And it just sort of summed it all up for me. The destruction of the natural world so that we can move into this mechanical world.
Exactly. I mean, and there's a very good book I would recommend. It's called Empire's Tracks by Manu Kuruka, and it was looking at how the railroads operated and that they were these corporations that collaborated with the military. So the government provided the military force to remove the original people off of the lands to put this corporate railroad through, and then the give and take around the land development. And what was quite interesting is it wasn't just the rails, that it was also the telegraph lines. And then after the telegraph lines became the fiber optic cables. And so there are these layers and layers of interconnectivity of modernity at the expense of the natural and the original, including, you know, the original people of Turtle Island. And so eventually that, you know, they got to the Golden Spike in Ogden, Utah. You know, they closed up the rails, and that was Leland Stanford, you know, Stanford University, which is a central player in so many aspects of both the computing and the finance and the cognitive neuroscience and, you know, many, many elements. But that history connects, right? And so as we look at potentially facing off around, a global planned demolition of the economy, you know, over the past 18 months through the central banking systems, that is the ultimate dispossession of the world from our access to the world as we know it. And for me, that was in many respects, the locomotives and the military killing the buffalo was the dispossession of the original people, because that was their food source, was the buffalo. So it was this mass dispossession that happened in the name of progress. And now I feel like what we're facing is a mass dispossession at the hands of the not only the central banking systems, but the defense sectors, the technology sectors, the biotech, synthetic biology sectors, to actually remove us from the sovereignty of our own living tissue, as frail and vulnerable as it may be, and selling us on this idea of sort of blockchain digital immortality and, you know, precision medicine. But that means that we'll have to live in their metaverse, and their metaverse is run by the people who are on the train shooting the buffalo.
I'm speaking with pioneering independent researcher Alison McDowell. Today's show, Blockchain Keys Unlock a Murky Metaverse. What you don't know about digital twins could hurt you. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
With regard to the Fourth Industrial Revolution, I guess that's the World Economic Forum term, and you just touched on this. Does the global economy have to be destroyed to make this fourth industrial revolution happen?
Well, so essentially they're creating a globalization is going to the next phase. And so, you know, we've been living through the implications of like global supply chains and reductions in labor and how that has fed dispossession and the prison industrial complex here for several decades, right? And the policies that were going along with global trade in goods. So the next phase is actually global trade in services. And this is something, I think his name is Richard Baldwin, who's at the Institute of Geneva. He speaks about globalization 4.0 and globotics, and this idea that trade and services, which happens already to a certain extent, like we have digitally platformed labor around tech work, some education work, some you know, call center work, these things that are already happening at a gig level on global leaderboards. But the next phase is that they will get automatic translation services of languages, and that they aim to get remote robotics such that we would, through a haptic suit and virtual reality, sort of place ourselves in a place on the other side of the planet and conduct business through a robot, whether that means a service-related job or running a factory or something, and that all of this would run based on reputation scoring, and AI would start to sort out who gets what jobs, based on digital badges and tokens, all of which, again, are on blockchain. They need the blockchain so that you will have quote-unquote trust when the AI assigns you a gig task to run the machine or, you know, operate a robot in a Japanese cafe or, you know, teach a child or, I mean, there was a United Nations paper where under Globotics, they were literally excited about the day where housekeepers in Kenya could clean hotel rooms in Norway and that gardeners in Mexico could mow lawns in Texas, all through remote robotics. There's a company called Sanctuary AI that's working on this. So what Baldwin says in this globalization 4.0 is that it is a totally different kind of physics applied to labor economics. And the potential for growth, quote unquote, you know, air quotes, like whatever growth means in the metaverse, and the speed at which it will happen, because it's no longer that, you know, a carton of grapes are picked in Chile and then packaged and taken to a warehouse and put on a cargo container and shipped across the Caribbean and taken out off the wharf and, you know, taken to another warehouse and then end up in a grocery store. That has a certain amount of physical finite time because it's a material good. When you have a digital representation of grapes, it's instantaneous. And that's what these NFTs are for. I mean, I don't think we're quite to having NFT food. But many, many other digital items are already being sold in that way and represented in that way. My friend, Raul Diego, he writes at Silicon Icarus, and he has a very interesting piece about fashion and clothing, and that they imagine a future where everybody just wears like a sustainable shift, and then you can project holographically some fancy fashion on top of it. But of course, all of that will probably depend on what you can pay and what tokens are in your social credit locker, you know, what kind of outfit you're allowed to wear, if you're allowed to wear something other than the standard muslin jumpsuit, you know, or nanotech jumpsuit, I guess it would be.
Oh my God. You have said that artificial intelligence wants to learn how to be human and learns from people. How does AI do this? Is it through these virtual headsets that I see being advertised on Twitter?
Well, I mean, I think it's in all of our digital footprints, right? You know, they're trying to digitally twin the world, and that's all part of the machine learning and the pattern recognition and the predictive profiling. And so all of this information becomes aggregated and weighted and used to inform the algorithms to make future predictions. And it's like reinforced learning. And what we're moving into now is that the ability of artificial intelligence systems to start to learn from unstructured data. Now, once everything is on blockchain, it will be much easier because that allows the data to be structured and organized in a way that is much more efficiently consumed by the algorithms. Right now, there's just a whole lot of unstructured data out there, but it's still learning. It's learning through these reinforcement systems. And for me, it's sort of like a frame. You know, John Trudell is someone whose teachings, he was a leader in the American Indian movement that I really hew to, and he frames this as a predator energy, right? And so that's something I've adopted. If you understand that beyond whatever scheming financial deals and transactions are being laid on this data, that the people who are running these games, you know, with our lives, they have more money than they can ever spend. And they really already have such concentrated power to like really, you know, treat people like playthings already. And so certainly they could always have a little more, but I think ultimately there's a program in place, this guy Perry Marshall, called Evolution 2.0, and it's about revisiting evolution post sort of Darwinian and looking back at Lamarck and looking at intelligent design and looking at information and communication theory as it applies to the world and transmitters and receivers and how that information is conveyed. And in that relationship of the transmitter and receiver of information, whether that is, you know, a chemical process or your DNA or happening in, you know, a fungal network or an alphabet or a story being told, that communication happens because they understand the encryption, they understand the meaning that is shared. But there is a third party outside that made the initial communication possible, and that is the higher power, like that is God. And so my sense from looking at this Evolution 2.0 project that they have underway, it's like one of these big competitions that will give you $10 million if you, you know, figure out essentially the third party part, the God part, is that if they could get enough data to crack the code of life, then maybe they too can be God, right? Like maybe they can attempt a coup of God. Now, I don't think that's actually possible, but in the games that they must play and, you know, in their minds about what they're doing, I think that is what their goal is to figure out the basic level of how life communicates with itself, how the universe communicates with itself, and then usurp that place to become the ultimate coder. So for me, if you look at things in that framework, then all of the data that is collected through these devices in the name of transparency, accountability, trackability, supply chains, blockchain, everything, is really about them getting so granular that they can get closer and closer to cracking the code. And so the extremes of lived experience, whether that is happening on how you're consuming your media, what you're watching in a virtual reality headset, what the biosensors that are monitoring all your organs. But I think foundationally, what they most want is people's spirits, people's souls, because, you know, I'm sure they have a lot of Fitbit data. I'm sure they have a lot of, you know, whatever, track my ride data, or, you know, people's, you know, leaderboard coupon shopping, you know, what they bought data. There's a lot of that random data out there, but it's the more unique data sets that I think, if they're trying to get a little bit of everything to get this code broken, that's the stuff that they want. And unfortunately, that means capturing the most beautiful aspects of being a human being, a natural human being, and probably the worst as well.
You have said that we cannot consent to this mechanical consciousness that is oncoming, that we are keepers of natural life. I like how you go out into the world on foot, exploring, and allow what you notice or what catches your eye to inform your next move and lead you to your next, shall we say, ceremony. I like how you allow the natural world to give you clues. Practicing reciprocity with the natural world is the way to go, don't you think?
I mean, it feels right to me. All I can do is model, I think. And, you know, there's no guidebook to this. I don't think any of us expected to be quite put in this position of trying to figure out such big and weighty things. But for me, I'd say, like, I like to live in the space of possibility. It's not always easy. And I can't say, like, I'm perfect at it all the time. But if you imagine that the world has these gifts waiting for you out there, and you know, part of what I think about within the metaverse and information theory, as long as we still hold navigating our own consciousness and our relationship to the world outside of having it be subject to mechanical intervention, is that we can weave the story together that we want to live in. And so, you know, I've had a bit of conflict with people in the recent past around this. And I won't say that there's any one proper approach. It's what makes sense to you. But for me, the story that I want to weave is something that there's a story of redemption. There's a story of healing. There's possibilities. And that is what the world offers if you go out and look for it. It's not a war story. It's a love story, really.
Alison McDowell, thank you so much. And thank you for all of your incredible work.
Oh, well, thanks. I just like to think about things, you know, and we can all do it.
I've been speaking with Alison McDowell. Today's show has been Blockchain Keys, Unlock a Murky Metaverse. What you don't know about digital twins could hurt you. Alison McDowell is a pioneering independent researcher. Her work interrogates the global finance and technology interests that, under the rising biosecurity state, are advancing a transhumanist program that would virtualize humans as digital commodities to be fed into futures markets to profit hedge funds. She asserts that it's time to unite from a place of love and spirit to halt an artificial intelligence coup of the natural world. There's a scorched path and a green path. It's time to choose. Visit her website at wrenchinthegears.com. That's wrenchinthegears.com. Access her videos on YouTube by searching for Allison McDowell. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.